Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just making life in the Royal City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Today I talked to Tim Gray, who is the Executive Director of Environmental Defense, an environmental advocacy group that aims to challenge and inspire change in government, business, and people to ensure a greener, healthier, and prosperous life for all. I got that from the website. Obviously, the new provincial government is keeping them very, very busy, and the latest controversy hits close to home here in Guelph with Bill 66. Now, this bill loosens many of the environmental protections around drinking water and the Green Belt, which are, let's say, sensitive areas for Guelphites. Fighting for the environment is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now here are some quotes from area mayors after Bill 66 was announced. "We don't need more development land. What we're attempting to do is develop smarter. Developing smarter means using existing infrastructure as much as humanly possible, so I would say no, leave the Greenbelt alone." That was from Fred Eisenberger, the mayor of Hamilton. "We will not be using the new powers outlined in Bill 66. Burlington residents benefit from environmental protections. We will not be compromising their safety or quality of life for speed." That was a tweet from Marianne Mead Ward, the mayor of Burlington. And then there's this. "Of course Guelph wants to be open for business. Of course, the province wants to be open for business, but definitely we need to be careful that it's not at the detriment of environmental policies, public participation, and these types of issues." That would be a quote from Guelph Mayor Cam Guthrie. Regardless of their politics and their positions in the province, these three mayors are united in their thinking that Bill 66 is not a great idea. But can anything be done? The Ford government has a majority and has proven in the recent past that they will use every and all means to accomplish their agenda. Surprisingly, though, Tim Gray is hopeful that the environmental lobby stands a chance at stopping Bill 66. Here's a bit about Gray himself. He started his career as the Ontario coordinator of the WWF's Endangered Spaces campaign. He worked as regional executive director for the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society. He was then project manager for WWF Central America, and then he was the national conservation director at Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society. He was recently the program director at the Ivy Foundation and is currently a member of the board of directors of Cornerstone Standards Council, Evidence for Democracy, Blue Green Canada, Oil Sands Advisory Group Alberta, and Ontario's Great Lakes Guardian Council. So in other words, he knows his stuff. So on this edition of the Guelph Politicast, we hear from Gray on why Bill 66 puts the Greenbelt at risk, what specifically people along the Greenbelt should be concerned about, and what the Ford government's environmental policy so far tells us about the man who said he'd protect the Greenbelt after being caught on camera saying he wanted to help developers claim it. We also talk about what concerned citizens can do, what impact that area city councils might have on the passage of Bill 66, and why he's so hopeful that Bill 66 isn't a done deal yet. So I caught up with Tim Gray by phone from his Toronto office last week. Tim Gray, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, nice to be here.
Let's dig right in. Specifically, with Bill 66, what puts the Green Belt at risk? What provisions in there make Bill 66 dangerous for the Green Belt?
Yeah, it's quite clear. The bill will allow these new bylaws that are being contemplated, these open for business bylaws, the protection provisions of the Greenbelt, that is the specific wording that stops residential, commercial, retail, and industrial development on the Greenbelt, that those provisions could be overridden by new bylaws that would be passed by municipalities, and those bylaws will be fast-tracked. They will not be open to public notice, nor to appeal. So this bylaw could be brought forward at a council meeting, passed, and then sent off to the provincial government for approval, and then you've got approval to proceed with opening up the Greenbelt. So these could come in from multiple municipalities throughout the Greenbelt area, and, of course, as we know, the municipal level of government is where the development industry has the biggest influence. Municipal politics does not have the same prohibitions around financial contributions and financial influence as provincial or federal politics do, and is notoriously influenced by the developer industry. So we can have every expectation that there'll be huge pressure to move forward to open up the green belt, and that's, of course, related to the fact that the developers themselves have huge opportunity to make massive amounts of money. You can imagine that if land, if you bought a farm that was within a protected zoning for maybe a few $100,000, and then you get it rezoned for residential development, your $400,000 or $500,000 investment can be worth $50 million. So,
right.
huge financial incentives. Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the path from this particular legislation to what we would actually see on the ground.
I think, you know, hearing people talk about the dangers of this, it's almost too big to wrap your head around. But, I mean, that's the nature of this, right? This is an omnibus bill that takes different things from different pieces of legislation and changes them all in this one big piece of legislation that's called Bill 66.
Yes, that's right. I mean, that's the Greenbelt legislation, but we have other land use protection legislation in this bill that would be similarly impacted. So we have the Lake Simcoe Protection Act, the Clean Water Act, the Great Lakes Protection Act, the Oak Ridges Moraine Act. So all of these pieces of legislation have land protecting designations in them that prohibit the development in certain areas. In the case of the Clean Water Act, that's around water supply for wells and cities' drinking water.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the Oak Ridges Moraine, that was it's a subset of the Green Belt, and that legislation was passed by the Conservative government in the 2000s under Mike Harris,
right.
As was the Lake Simcoe Protection Act. So what's really interesting, I think, here is that about a 30 or 40-year legacy of increasing amounts of protection for critical natural heritage and farmland areas within the Greater Golden Horseshoe that started with Bill Davis Tories and then NDP. And then, you know, it's just like this has been a multi-decadal, multi-government approach to changing our land use trajectory in Southern Ontario. And this government is trying to undo it all in one fell swoop.
You mentioned the influence part of this, and I wonder if you saw this. They were having the financial disclosures from the election, and the Ontario Proud Facebook group apparently got a lot of donations from developers who, I guess, who's pulling the strings kind of thing, but it does feel like developers were stepping up their game a little in terms of trying to get a government who would be a bit more friendly to their concerns. Not that I'm trying to get too conspiratorial, of course, but, you know, the facts are the facts.
Yeah, I don't think you need to get very conspiratorial to see the path. It's interesting to see that, you know, Ontario Proud, which characterized itself as citizen-supported during the election campaign, turns out to have been corporate-supported, and a very narrow slice of the corporate world, as you can see, about 90% of their contributions that they spent on massive promotion of Facebook messaging was from the development community.
Mm-hmm.
And then, my experience to date after this bill has been introduced is that there was very limited knowledge of the contents of this bill within even ministers' offices beyond the center of this government. So it feels and smells to me like the legislation was very tightly crafted between representatives of the development industry and the core of the current Ontario government. And, of course, their election, to a large degree, can be attributed to the support work that was done by Ontario Proud.
Right.
So, I think the line is not thin. It's more like a thick black marker.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to the legislation itself, though, because the procedural piece to this, and I'm not sure how it works in other municipalities. I know how planning and rezoning works here in Guelph, but the idea that, you know, you could, within a few weeks' time, have a green field and then have shovels in the ground, I think that's very disturbing to a lot of people, because I think particularly people who are concerned about development in the environment here in Guelph know that there's a process, that an application comes to the city, that there's a statutory public hearing where people can come out, have their say. There's, you know, further massaging of the development plan, and then a finished proposal comes forward where, if all goes according to plan, it's something that the neighborhood, the city, as a corporation, and the developer can all move forward with. So I guess in from where you have examined this proposed legislation, how has that changed? How have they tightened that timeline up specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's changed in a couple of ways. I mean, one is that, especially over the last 10 to 12 years since we brought in the growth plan, mm-hmm. You know, there's a real focus on trying to contain urban expansion and focus industrial development, residential development, et cetera, within existing urban boundaries, and try and slow the rate at which they're growing onto farmland generally, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not just on the green belt, but even off the green belt. Because we have such a finite supply of farmland and the costs of sprawl for existing taxpayers are very high to build new infrastructure such as sewers and water supply and bus routes, et cetera, like low-density development across large areas is very expensive to pay for the taxpayer.
Right.
So we've been trying to rein that in. And, you know, I think so what the requirement has been is that you have to do, a municipal comprehensive review, which is essentially a regional plan, and then all the smaller communities within that have to conform with that. Mm-hmm. And that needs to be done all at one time. It needs to be evidence-based about how many people are expected to move into the community, what the housing needs are, what the development needs are for industry, et cetera. And then once that decision is made, you implement it, and then you revisit it again 10 years later, right? You don't, like, take it apart, you know, two weeks after
right.
you finalize it, right? So this both undercuts that rational approach to planning following guidelines that are intended to create greater density, more affordable housing, less sprawl. But it also, at the very specific level, completely constrains the ability of the public even to know that this sideswipe of the local plan is going to occur. And before anyone knows that the council meeting has happened or that the bylaw has been sent off to Queen's Park for approval, the approvals are in place.
Mm.
And so it's bad planning at the first stage, and then it's subverting local democracy at second. So it's a double negative.
Mm-hmm.
That does not make it a positive, by the way.
Right. Considering all that, what role does, you know, the tribunal play? Because that was recently revamped, and, you know, I've seen it here in Guelph that a lot of developments and a lot of, you know, the official plan amendments end up in front of the OMB before, you know, when there wasn't the OMB instead of the tribunal is now. But has that, given the plans laid out in Bill 66, is the tribunal just irrelevant in that?
It is, unfortunately. I mean, I think the creation of the new Local Planning Appeals Tribunal is an improvement over the old OMB, because the OMB before was used as a tool by the development industry to stop the implementation of regional plans, and they delayed implementation and cost municipalities and taxpayers tens of millions of dollars fighting for the municipal plans that they themselves had approved by elected local government. So replacement of it with something that's no longer allowed to do that is great, but these new open for business bylaws will not be reviewable by the LPAT, so they've been taken out of the equation.
That's interesting, because that's, you know, with the dismantling of the environmental commissioner and the francophone commissioner, you know, now we're saying the LPAT's irrelevant, the tribunal's kind of irrelevant. It's another sign that, you know, we're losing oversight capacity at the government level.
Sure. I mean, this whole package of reforms, this red tape cutting that's in this bill, is really about providing opportunities for developers to fast-track sprawl onto farmland. And the stated reason, which is that they need to do this to make room for locating new factories for development, is directly contradicted by information that has been brought forward over the last couple of months at public hearings the government themselves have been holding, where municipalities have been complaining that there's a huge surplus of employment lands. There's not nearly enough new large job-creating factories moving to Ontario to use up the lands that have been allocated in regional plans.
Right.
And that they need to find some other use for these lands, including, you know, mixed use or residential or retail and residential, et cetera. So they don't need it at any kind of macro scale. And then, of course, the Minister of Municipal Affairs has the authority under what's called Minister's Zoning Order, that if they really had, like, say Elon Musk showed up with said, I'd build a battery gigafactory, but the only place I'll build it is in the middle of the greenbelt.
Right.
And you need to, like, give me this piece of land right there. And if government really believed that the only way to land those 10,000 jobs was to do what Elon Musk wanted and build it in the middle of the greenbelt, then they could do that, right? And then they can explain to the public why that was so necessary. But that's highly unlikely. Anybody who wants to build a factory wants to build it close to existing sewers and water and roads and where people can actually get to work to work there. It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So, and we know that at a macro level, there's a huge surplus of land available right now for siting new industrial, retail, and residential infrastructure. So there's no need basis to this. It's driven by speculation.
So the justification doesn't exist. There's already pretty loud opposition to this, and the opposition comes from local mayors as well, who are going to be affected by this. But before I get there, I want to talk about Doug Ford himself, because there was that very famous tape during the campaign of him saying he wants to open the Greenbelt for development, and then he denied that and said, he wants to protect the Greenbelt. And then Bill 66 happens, and I think he again stated that he does not want to see the Greenbelt developed. I think it's hard for a lot of people to know where to or know how to articulate an opposition position when it seems like the premier himself doesn't know what his position is or doesn't seem to understand the legislation that he's brought forward.
Yeah, I can't explain how the premier says he doesn't want to develop the Greenbelt when he's just introduced legislation that would do just that. That's somebody has to ask him that question directly, I guess. But I think what the public needs to do is to connect with their local MPPs and make it clear to them that this is completely unacceptable. This is a democracy. We do have representatives that we elect. And, at some point, the people who have been elected by people throughout the Greenbelt and throughout the Greater Golden Horseshoe are accountable for the legislation that they're going to vote for. And I think everyone should be seeking commitments from their MPP that when this bill comes back to the House sometime after February 19th, and comes up for second reading before it goes to committee, is that it's either withdrawn or this entire section that fundamentally undoes our approach to smart growth and protection of natural values and farmland in southern Ontario is removed.
Right.
And I wouldn't take anything less than that as an answer from my MPP.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you know who Guelph's MPP is, and I think he's on side.
Yes, I'm sure that a number of the MPPs on the opposition side of the House have very strong views of this.
Right.
And I think what's key here, of course, is to add a significant number. The magic number is 13 for a vote.
Right.
13 conservative MPPs need to recognize the complete acceptability of this act and vote against it, and then it won't pass.
Which doesn't seem implausible, because the Greenbelt affects a lot of areas in the GTHA, and a lot of those places are represented by PC MPPs.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I did a count of them a little while ago, and I think it's like 18 conservative MPPs on the Greenbelt itself, so including three cabinet ministers. So, it's a very large area, so it's not surprising that you have so many MPPs, and a number of them would be government members.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about the other side of this, which is the municipal side, because we've had Fred Eisenberg come out and say that he doesn't support, he's the mayor of Hamilton, as you know, he doesn't support development of the Greenbelt, neither does Marianne Mead Ward. the mayor of Burlington, our mayor, Cam Guthrie, has said he doesn't support Bill 66. I guess my question here is, does the fact that we have mayors against it, does that help any efforts in opposition to Bill 66? And the other question is, if in the event that Bill 66 goes forward, is the opposition by these mayors any sort of security that the Green Belt isn't going to be developed?
I think it's great that mayors are standing up and saying that this is a bad idea, and they have a direct experience with the consequences of sprawl, the pressure, upward pressure on their tax base, the erosion of quality of life, the inability to develop proper public transit, etc. Anybody who's been a long-serving mayor or municipal politician who's looking out for their constituents' rights will recognize that. So that's great that they're doing that. I think in the longer term, though, it's going to be very difficult under this new legislative framework for the municipal politicians to resist the grinding and relentless pressure, both day-to-day but also financially within the campaign cycle for municipal politics, to resist the power and money of developers who can use this rapid development clause to pressure, push, and bring on side municipal representatives who will do their bidding. Mm. So it's a long-term undermine and a long-term negative impact on both democratic freedom and representational ability of municipal politicians to represent the long-term economic interests of their constituents.
Mm-hmm. So money talks.
Money will talk, and it talks very, very loudly at the municipal level.
Mm. So having said that, I think, again, we have to assume that the PC caucus is going to hold together because they certainly haven't shown any sign of cracking too terribly much in everything that's happened so far. I think what we need to start looking at is having more eyes on the municipal governments and making sure that these things sort of don't get buried.
Yeah, in the longer term, I mean, I think that would be a mistake to think that, you know, we should, you know, assume that the path of least resistance here is to let this government get away with passing this bill and then we can win these battles at the local level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very, very fragmented attention, you know, community groups and folks with very limited capacity fighting developers with bottomless pockets.
Mm.
You know, our chance to actually stop this is now. It's between now and February or March when this bill would pass in the legislature. And the consequences for every community in terms of increased costs, increased risk to their water quality, destruction of their quality of life, lack of loss of recreational area, loss of farmland, increased gridlock, like all the consequences of poorly planned development going on to places that should be protected, everyone has something to lose here except the people who are the land speculators.
Mm.
So I think everyone needs to mobilize and make it very, very clear to this government that they cannot pass this bill. And I think that the public's going to do that.
Right, and part of the intent was to drop it on the last day of the legislative session, and which is 2 weeks before Christmas, and then, you know, hopefully after Christmas, Christmas will have been so great we have all forgotten about it, which I guess maybe speaks to how deeply cynical this government is in terms of its expectations of the people.
Well, the having it tabled in the House and then having no ability of the opposition to criticize it, of course, reduces that Queen's Park coverage of the issue.
Mm.
And but I don't think it's going to matter. I think people are obviously going to take some time off for Christmas, but they're also going to spend some of that time over the holidays organizing. And I think you'll very much see the public hitting the ground running once they wake up from New Year's Day. And by the time this comes back to the legislature in February, you'll get to see the product of all that organizing, I think.
I have to remind myself that it's only been half a year since Doug Ford took office. I'm curious, looking forward, in terms of the issues you're fighting on, what does this tell you about the broader Ford agenda, and in terms of what you have to be doing for the next 3.5 years in order to keep environmental issues front and center and keep things from, you know, keep these eruptions like Bill 66 happening, you know, what does your day look like these days?
Well, it's obviously very busy. I mean, we lost the climate change plan for Ontario that was passed by the last government, which was quite good, and put a price on carbon and returned the proceeds to the public and industry in the forms of programs that would further reduce emissions and help with the transition. So that was a huge loss to climate action in Ontario. You know, we now have this bill. We have the downgrading of the Environmental Commissioner office, and it feels that in a time when we do not have the luxury of going backwards around a transition to a cleaner economy, to making smarter decisions about how to protect farmland and biodiversity, that we are going backwards. And you know, I think all the information that's out there, most people in the public have a sense and a well-learned sense that we have you can count them on two hands, and you know, on your 10 fingers, the number of years we have to really fundamentally change the way that we run our economy and our energy system.
Mm-hmm.
And going backwards is not an option that civilization will survive. So any politician who's on the side of making things worse at this time is very dangerous. And I really do feel that this government has moved to the side of being a threat to that future. And I think it's completely unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. I guess the problem here is even for people like me who pay close attention is, you know, trying to keep this front of mind, and we've touched on what sort of people can do, but in terms of, I mean, it's so easy for people to sort of feel powerless in these situations, and you know, my voice can't make a difference, but. In terms of suggestions, you mentioned getting in touch with your MPP, but in terms of raising awareness and also in trying to understand the complexities, what can people do?
Well, people, you know, obviously listen to, you know, podcasts like this or, you know, reading the newspaper and digging in and trying to find out more about the details is always good, because then you're speaking from a base of knowledge and information, and that's always a good way to engage your neighbors or your family or your MPP. But I think people make a huge mistake to think that them phoning up their MPP or demanding a meeting about an issue like this doesn't make any difference.
Mm.
You know, I know from experience that when a member of parliament or a member of provincial parliament, you know, gets a half dozen phone calls or even like, you know, one or two people demanding a meeting about something, they know that that's like the tip of the iceberg in terms of public opinion in their area. So, you know, it makes a huge difference. And if you could, you know, have a dinner at your house and talk about this, or lunch, or you know, a beer, it's close to the holidays, have a beer, have a glass of wine. You know, talk about what this means to you and what means to your community and to your kids, and then say, yeah, you know, we're all going to go. You know, six of us, we're going to go, and we're going to ask for a meeting with our MPP, and we're going to talk to them about this and why this is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
I can guarantee you that if four or five of you show up at their office to talk about this, that they're going to talk to their people in their caucus about why this matters and why people care about it. And, you know, every single MPP is up for election every 4 years. And if they've got some issue like this that isn't going to go away, but the implementation of it is just going to roll on and be awful for the next 4 years, in order for them to brush it off, they have to believe that it won't make any difference electorally.
Right.
But if they are hearing from thousands of people, they will be very worried that it does make a difference.
Right.
And I have seen this happen, like, again and again and again. So people dismiss their own power at their own peril if they don't take advantage of the power that they can wield with their neighbors and friends.
Good enough. I did want to ask you about one last thing, and it does concern a very specific to Guelph, or at least Guelph's MPP, because Mike Schreiner was going to introduce this week before, actually today as we're recording this, before the legislature rose, he was going to introduce his private member's bill about protecting the Paris Gulf Moraine. And I'm wondering, I mean, that was always going to be an uphill climb because it's a private member's bill from an opposition MP, but in terms of the what the government has done now with Bill 66 and how that might affect the Oak Ridges Moraine and other environmentally sensitive pieces of legislation. What do you think the odds are that you know, that piece of legislation to protect the Paris Gull Moraine, what do you think the odds are that could be become law?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, on the face of it, as you said, you wouldn't think that it would be much chance when they're passing legislation that would essentially make the green belt moot.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the previous government was consulting on expansion of the green belt, mm-hmm. and there was strong public support for that, in particular around some of these areas that are really important for drinking water protection, like the moraines. So, you know, my feeling is that the public response to how ridiculous Bill 66 is and dismantling the Greenbelt is could quite easily result in renewed momentum to expand the Greenbelt, as most people want to see happen.
Mm.
So I don't think people should stop pushing it. I mean, I think, Mike Schreiner's bill is modeled quite closely after that which created the Oak Ridges Moraine,
mm-hmm.
which was a conservative bill back in the 2000s,
mm-hmm.
by Mike Harris. So it's not something outside of the realm of reasonableness for multiple governments over the last 30 years. So, congrats for introducing it to him. And, more power to the people that are pushing for the expansion of the Green Belt in multiple areas, because it's a very effective tool, or has been. And we need to push that kind of land protection forward in Southern Ontario.
Well, from your lips to Mike's ears. Tim Gray, thank you so much for your time. I know we're not done talking about this, but we'll see what happens in the new year.
Great. All the best.
And once again, that was Tim Gray. To find out more about environmental defense, you can go to their website, environmentaldefense.ca. That is defense with a C. So environmental, DEFENCE.ca. And while you're there, you can also read Gray's blog. As for Bill 66, it will be debated more fully when the legislature returns as scheduled in February, and it will be around then that you can hear more about Mike Schreiner's private member's bill to protect the Paris Gull Moraine as well. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes, and while you're there, you can also listen to Open Source's Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can go to the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you would like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.